It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The reality is that once the refugees are arriving, particularly here in the United States, is quite frequently they're unprepared for life here. A frequent thing that we hear from the refugees is that in the camps, they can make their own house, they can, you know, get the food easily, they don't have a lot of stress in their life. But once they come here to the United States, they have to find a job, they have to pay rent, and so there's a number of different things that increase stress on them that they have to think about in order to live that previously they didn't.
Michael and Thinthin Rogers from Burma Connect talk about the struggles of Burmese refugees trying to navigate life and the legal system in Richmond, Virginia. And in this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how a coordinated national campaign, the Loan Modification Scam Prevention Network, was created to combat con artists who seek to take advantage of desperate and distressed homeowners. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show was supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 99, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Loan Modification Scam Prevention Network, led by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and NeighborWorks America, has a national campaign to prevent loan modification scams through public education, complaint reporting, and coordination with local, state, and federal enforcement agencies. The network has a website, www.preventloanscams.org, which supports national, state, and local law enforcement efforts. The website includes an electronic complaint form that can be filled out by an individual who has been scammed or by counselors or friends helping a victim of fraud, names of individuals and organizations who have been identified by enforcement agencies to have allegedly committed a loan modification scam, information on how to avoid a loan modification scam, state-by-state information about rules, regulations, and resources available to homeowners, and news and information on enforcement efforts. Homeowners who believe they may have been a victim of a loan modification scam also can call the Homeowners Help Hotline at 1-888-995-HOPE to log a complaint and to receive free foreclosure prevention counseling. In other news, a Roanoke landlord who tried to evict a tenant by turning off her water, reporting her to Child Protective Services, and summoning police to roust her from her bed must pay $13,600 in damages. Shannon Boyd's struggle with her landlord, Gunther Gass, began in December when she notified him she had lost her job and would be unable to pay her $575 monthly rent until she got her final paycheck. In response, the landlord turned the water off and reported the tenant to Child Protective Services. The landlord then called police, came to the duplex, and unlocked the door so officers could enter. The officers charged the tenant with trespassing and told her to leave the apartment. The trespassing charge was thrown out when it came to court. The tenant then sued the landlord, and after a full hearing, the judge told the landlord, who had more than 15 years' experience as a landlord, that he knew how to lawfully evict someone, but instead showed a willful and wanton disregard for the tenant's rights and violated his own lease with her. The judge awarded the tenant $8,600 in damages and awarded $5,000 in attorney's fees to the Legal Aid Society of Roanoke Valley, who represented the tenant. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Which two things are true when you sign a contract in Virginia? A, you read it, understood it, and agreed with it, even if you can't read. B, you have 3 days to cancel it. Or C, you can't change it unless you sign something else. The correct answers are A, you read it, understood it, and agreed with it, even if you can't read. And C, you can't change it unless you sign something else. Unless it's a door-to-door sale or it's a certain type of mortgage, you don't have 3 days to cancel, and the contract takes effect immediately. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
We're here at the offices of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, and we're speaking with Mike Rogers and Tintin Rogers. They live in Madison, Wisconsin, and they have an organization called Burma Connect. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tell us, please, what is Burma Connect?
We established Burma Connect about a year ago as an online and over-the-phone interpretation company to help assist with Burmese refugees, primarily, who needed to have interpretation services.
Hello, my name is Tintin Rogers. I am a Burmese. I came here from Burma about 11 years ago, and I'm a Burmese interpreter helping and working with Burmese refugees.
Now, I understand that there are about 140,000 Burmese refugees in refugee camps, primarily along the Thailand-Burma border. Can you tell us what has caused this situation?
Primarily, the reason that there are so many refugees that are seeking asylum in Thailand is that the military dictatorship in Burma has frequently waged ethnic cleansing campaigns and also forced labor and forced relocation of people who live in the villages along where they would like to do construction projects. And so you have a lot of people who are pushed out. The military will come in and burn their houses down, bulldoze them, take the able-bodied people, and force them into slave labor, essentially. And so ahead of the Burmese military coming in doing these activities, the people will flee. So you've got a mix of people who are political refugees, economic refugees, and the people who are just forcibly relocated, and they cross the border into Thailand. There's also quite a few people in Thailand who are there economically to get jobs because there just aren't any available in Burma.
Now, I understand that about 65,000 of these Burmese refugees are currently in the United States. Can you tell us how they came to arrive here?
The State Department has a program where they allow people to immigrate into the United States from a variety of reasons, and every year they select a host of countries where there's a need to have refugees relocated. And I would say about 10 years ago, there was a small trickle of Burmese refugees that came in, and I guess those would probably primarily be the political refugees. In the past 5 years, though, the number of refugees that have come from the camps in Thailand into the United States has increased significantly. It's usually about 5,000 or 6,000 each year. which comes up to about 15 to 16% of all incoming refugees to the United States. I'm not exactly sure of the precise reason why there was this sharp uptake, but I believe it has something to do with economic stresses in Thailand, and Thailand being a strategic ally of the United States, and them asking for assistance in decreasing the camp populations because of the economic burden that they face of supporting all of them.
What type of preparation, if any, do the refugees get before they come to the U.S.? What are they told about the U.S. in terms of the services that would be available to them or the experience that they'll have?
Well, what I learned from them is that they did have the orientation to just give basic information, but they said that it wasn't enough. So what kind of information they get is like they have to have signature and they have to ask people when they sign something, they have to have a copy back. You know, because in Burma, we don't sign on the paper at all, and nobody has signature on the piece of paper, so they have to practice signing.
I think the real crux of the problem is that the people who are managing the UN camps there, they're very caring people, and they want the refugees who are immigrating elsewhere to succeed, and so they genuinely are trying to help them out, and perhaps unintentionally, they're portraying a very positive picture as a way to, you know, to promote what's happening so that the refugees are, you know, interested in doing this. But the reality is that once the refugees are arriving, particularly here in the United States, is quite frequently they're unprepared for life here. A frequent thing that we hear from the refugees is that in the camps, they can make their own house. They can, you know, get the food easily. They don't have a lot of stress in their life. But once they come here to the United States, they have to find a job, they have to pay rent, and so there's a number of different things that increase stress on them that they have to think about in order to live that previously they didn't. Even though the conditions were worse in the camps, there was just a lot less stress because pretty much they were cared for 100%.
Now, I understand that we have this Burmese refugee situation right here in Richmond, that there are Burmese refugees in the Richmond area. Can you tell us about how many there are and how did they get here?
What happens is the State Department, when they're bringing in refugees to the United States, there are a number of agencies or groups every year that petition the State Department to be able to take in refugees of assorted types. And so each of these groups, they try to set up support structures in their local regions. And then they will come in and sort of petition the State Department to say, next year we have the capacity to take on X number of refugees of this type, you know, from Eastern Europe or from Asia or whatever. And the State Department will sort of divvy that up. And so what happens is for the Burmese refugees in particular, they'll be brought in and they'll be assigned a host location, host city, where they're going to immigrate to, a place that's going to take them in. And presumably the groups that are helping them assist them and integrate into their new host city are supposed to provide them with basic living skills. The State Department requires that they have some access to English language and also some basic job training skills. I mean, the State Department really wants to integrate these people into society so that they're functional members. And what they're doing typically through monies paid out by the Faith-Based Initiatives Program is you would have, say, Catholic Charities or Lutheran Social Services setting up these programs to assist the refugees. So for the Richmond area, there was a group that was here that petitioned the State Department and said, okay, we will be willing to take in X number of refugees.
So you've told us that the refugees are supposed to get basic life skill training, job training, at least access to English. And now you've met with the Burmese refugees here in Richmond a couple of times now.
Yes.
What are they actually getting?
From their own words, the services they've been getting sort of change over time. I think prior to the recent economic troubles, they were getting perhaps better services in terms of assistance in filling out forms and dealing with like setting up Medicaid and getting Section 8 housing. But then once the more recent economic troubles hit the country and the world, really, it seemed to me they indicated that their level of services had declined somewhat.
Well, what they're lacking is that support, moral support sometimes too. They don't have, if they are faced with problems, they don't have anywhere to go to. Some of the refugees resettlement agencies in different areas, they, even though the first initial 8 or 6 months is, you know, what they're responsible for, even after 8 months, they can still go and seek some moral assistance. But they, from what I understand, they are not getting it from this agency. They're, I don't want to say neglect, but that's what they feel, because they are not finding jobs and helping them with taking them to job places to apply for jobs, because most refugees here don't know how to read or write in their own language, let alone, you know, learn to fill out applications in English.
So I gather the sponsoring agency is supposed to provide them services for a period of time. You mentioned 8 months, and they may or may not be fulfilling that commitment, but it's certainly not an open-ended commitment. So how did the Burmese refugees survive once these services end, whether it's before or after 8 months? For example, do they get public assistance? Are they eligible for it? And if so, are they actually getting it?
Yes, most of them live on food stamp, and if both in the household, nobody works, and they also get Medicaid. And so they basically live in a government housing in food stamp and Medicaid, and they don't get, some people have cash assistance, which is called TANF. And so they basically live on that government support.
Additionally, when we met with the refugees here in Richmond, the Burmese immigrants here indicated that there was a group called VCC, Virginia Church Council. They indicated that about a third of them were getting housing provided from that group. And it sounded like the arrangement was is that rather than have Section 8 housing, they were getting housing that VCC had already paid for. And then as they worked, a sliding scale portion of their income would go back to VCC to pay for the housing that they were living in. But there was about a third of them that were not in Section 8 housing that were actually getting housing provided through VCC.
So I see that there's some minimal housing assistance provided and some minimal public assistance provided. What about employment? Are these folks, you say, a lot of them are, they can't read or write Burmese, let alone English, and of course they don't have English skills. Do you find that any of them are getting jobs, and if so, how?
I think the vast majority of them are actually currently unemployed. There are a few exceptions. Few of the families do have adults who are working. That's their primary complaint, is the lack of employment. They have a very difficult time finding employment, and the primary thing that's preventing them from getting employment is ability to actually apply for jobs. You know, they might go somewhere to, say, a cleaning company or, to the any sort of unskilled labor positions that are available, and they can't fill the forms out, and nobody's providing them assistance in helping to fill those forms out.
Now, I assume that many of these refugee or really immigrant families have children who are school age. They're entitled to a free, appropriate public education. What type of educational services are these children receiving?
Well, they're receiving what American children are receiving. But with the difference is most kids never went to, got the formal education back in the camp or back in our country. So they never learned to write or read, and they're having to put in the age-appropriate classes where they're struggling educationally.
So in other words, if a child is here, let's say 10 years old, are they placed in fourth grade where they normally would be, or are they placed in a lower grade where they could benefit from the education?
Well, that's actually an interesting situation with a lot of the refugee families. In the camps in the Thai-Burma border that are run by the UN, frequently the families will overstate the ages of their children in order to get additional resources from the UN. I guess they're age-based, the amount of food or benefits that they're provided. And so, subsequently, these people, they don't have any sort of documentation. There's no birth certificates. There's no official record from where they came from about their ages. The only official record of their age is what the UN agency has established for them. So when they come here to the United States, frequently the children are 1 or 2 years older on paper than what they actually are in, you know, their actual age. And so you would think that being placed in the schools, that there would be some sort of a test or some sort of evaluation to find out how well the children can interact within the educational setting and be placed appropriately. It seems like that's not happening, and they're just placing them in classes based on what their age on paper is. So what's happening is there are lots and lots of Burmese refugee children who are in classroom settings that are 1 to 2 years above what they would be based on their age, with no consideration whatsoever for their actual educational abilities. As Thinthin mentioned, a lot of the people coming from the camps, a lot of the children who were born in the camps, have received no formal education outside of maybe a basic rudimentary kindergarten setting. Many of them can't read, they can't write, they've never even been in a formal classroom setting, and they're being sort of thrust into that. And some of the kids are doing okay, but a lot of them are struggling, particularly, I think, on the emotional development side of things, because they're with kids that are a lot older than them, and they can't even communicate with those kids. And so they're being picked on, they're smaller than their peers, they're not understanding what's going on. And subsequently, these children have a really negative image about school, and which is tragic because, you know, there's an opportunity here for them to sort of break out of that cycle of being dependent on society to survive. And, you know, if they can be educated and learn to enjoy school, it's going to give them a lot of opportunity to become productive in society. But they're missing that opportunity because of the negative situation that they're being placed in.
And as I understand the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, persons of limited English proficiency are required to be provided meaningful access to the government services that they're seeking, and this must be provided at no cost. And this applies pretty much across the board to social services, health departments, a division of motor vehicles, schools, police, area agencies on aging, other health providers. But you're finding that this legal mandate simply is not being carried out.
Pretty much. Originally, there was a Supreme Court case where Chinese immigrant families in San Francisco sued the school there because they said that their children weren't receiving meaningful access to education. And at that time, the Supreme Court ruled in their favor, and they said that because this was a federally funded program, that they had to provide them interpretation services. Later, there was another case that went to the Supreme Court where there was a lady in, I think it was Georgia, and she wanted to get a driver's license, and she could read road signs, but she couldn't read the test, which was in English. And she sued, saying that she was discriminated against because she couldn't get a driver's license because the written driving test wasn't provided to her in Spanish. First of all, the Supreme Court said that the Title VI of the 1965 Civil Rights Act was true, and it should be upheld that access to language should be provided by state-funded programs and agencies. However, it said that citizens couldn't directly sue places for not providing that was a function of the funding mechanism of those programs, so that if there was discrimination that was happening because there was no language access provided, that they would have to file a complaint with the Department of Justice. And then the Department of Justice would then go through and either force the agency to make changes or then could penalize them by decreasing their funding. And it's not only federal funding. I think the presidential decree was that any federal, state, or local government service should provide meaningful access via interpretation services for any person engaging those services who didn't speak English.
And it sounds like a very complex problem, and we appreciate you being here to share your insights with us. We have been speaking with Michael Rogers and Tintin Rogers, and they are with Burma Connect, and they're passing through Richmond on the way back to Madison, Wisconsin. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
It's time for our weekly quiz called,
Is that legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Which two protections do Virginia employees have? A, you can't be forced to work on your day of rest. B, you can't be forced to pay for a medical exam needed for your job. Or C, you can't be forced to work overtime. If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Ever wonder where you can go to get quick, low-cost, and effective justice? Join us next week when the Honorable Robert Pastilnik, City of Richmond General District Court Judge, reveals the ins and outs of the Small Claims Court, often called the People's Court, in the 100th original broadcast of this program. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.